dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Welcome everyone to Binary Revolution Radio, episode number 169. Oh yeah. You are joining the man himself, Buck Dangler, back on the show after a very long hiatus. Coming to you on October 17th, 2006. And joining me on the Prawn episode this week is one of my fellow actors in the industry, if you will, who goes by the name of Johnny Rosebud.
Hey, that's Johnny Swank, tough guy.
I'm sorry, Johnny Swank on the show with us this week. Johnny, how's life treating you there, buddy? You've been gone for a while. You've been doing some film? You've been doing some, getting some side work or what?
Yeah, I'm a little worn out, so I'm taking a break. You know, the doctors advised that otherwise they said certain parts of my anatomy would just fall off. So,
well,
I think,
you know,
it's going to be good for me.
Sometimes you just got to give it a break and then go back re-energized.
Sometimes you feel like a nut, and sometimes you don't.
Well, you know, if you feel like a nut, I think the industry pay scale doubles, doesn't it? I wouldn't know. I'm just saying I heard things. have to ask the guys out in California about that one. Notice how I left out any company name or people's names there. So, we are here for episode 169, and we have an abbreviated show this week, actually. We will still have a good full show, but actually both Johnny Swank and I have a couple business ventures coming up here in the future, and personally I've got a little porn convention type sort of thing that I have to go to. So we are actually recording this on a, what is today, Saturday afternoon. So you're listening to this on Tuesday the 17th, but this was recorded a couple days earlier because, you know, I got to get down to business and make that money, you know what I'm saying? So let's do a little housekeeping here. Now, Johnny Swank, if I remember correctly, you're good friends, so I think we have a mutual friend by the name of Not Theory. Have you got any news from him? He's been working on some side things over there, bringing some things back. Did you have any progress you wanted to report on that, or?
Absolutely nothing. Haven't touched anything. I haven't even used the computer machine in the past, many months.
Okay.
I'm just messing around.
How do you upload your porn?
What's that?
How do you upload your porn, then?
Yeah, I have fluffers for that. They take care of it all.
They're fluffers, and they're technically savvy.
Well, yeah. You know, in this day and age, fluffers have to be personal assistants and, you know, do all that kind of stuff. And they do all the video editing on a Mac, so I don't want to touch it.
Oh, yeah. I don't blame you on that one.
You know, I don't really care that, you know, they've been fluffing everybody and they're touching the computer. That's fine. But it's a Mac, and that's the dirty part.
That's the part you don't want to touch it. It's not all the gist days. Oh, all right. Well, wait a minute. The Macs have, like, those clear keyboards. Like, don't they have some kind of coating that's, like, jizz protection that it just all...
Oh, these things got a coating now, I'll tell you that.
Man. All right, well, let's do some housekeeping before we get too awful sick. In case you haven't figured out, this might be a very not-safe-for-work episode, so... Or not safe for your cab, or wherever
you
happen
to be. Something we might have wanted to tell them that about 5 minutes ago.
Oh, well, better late than never.
That's true.
Oh, all right. So, what do you got? Anything to announce? Any progress?
Well, I've been, I know I always say I'm chipping away at things, but we've been working on Freak Factor, of all things. We got a new interface planned. Actually, the new interface is up and running. We're doing a bunch of testing on it, and I hesitate to say it, but I'd say in the next couple of weeks we might be doing either a live test or an actual episode. So.
See, of all the projects, why Freak Factor? I mean, that show sucks.
Yeah, it does suck. But it's, you know, the only thing people ever email us about.
Right. It's the most loved and hated show at the same time. And actually, it is coming along. It was looking pretty cool. We did some testing late into last night, and it is definitely getting there. I mean, I think we should probably clarify that, you know, we kind of still have the same setup we had before. And to reiterate, this was all an experimental thing from the beginning. We didn't know what to expect. We didn't have any big plans or anything like that for the show other than the random chaos that goes on. And now, it's still going to happen, but we're adding some new interfaces, and when I say we, I mean, of course, you. Adding some new interfaces, some different... actually, I'm not even going to tell exactly what they are, because they're so cool, people will definitely like them, but some registration so that we can get some people more involved into it and have a little bit more control over what happens to prevent things like toning and a little bit too much chaos at times. So It's a lot of interface stuff and control stuff over the show, right?
Yeah, definitely. And one thing that, you know, kind of was a big problem with the first incarnation of Freak Factor was the registration. We had a separate registration where people would, like, record their name, and we would go through there and set it up. Nobody wanted to listen to the directions, so it got really annoying after a while. So now we're going to have, instead of a separate Freak Factor and Bell's Mind accounts, just your Bell's Mind account will be your Freak Factor account. And the registration will be back up. Hopefully tonight, so that people can start registering for Bell's Mind again. I guess by the time you guys hear it, the registration will be up yesterday. So.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's... I don't know. One of the things I enjoyed most about the last registration was, you know, when you'd call up and all they were supposed to do was say their name, and you'd get 5 minutes of somebody saying their name, and then they'd go, "Hello, is anyone there? Hello?
Oh, yeah.
My name is this. Are you adding me right now? I can't hear you. Hello?"
I think actually the best part about the registration last time was that we had people, you know, the registration initially said, "Please record your name," right?
That's it.
And they would record their name, no big deal. But then it became a problem because people would say, you know, "My handle is, you know, Lito X4 or something," and they would just babble some crazy handle, and we'd have no idea how to spell it. And then we would spell it, and they'd say, "Oh, you spelled it wrong. You know, it's got 7 3s in it instead of 6. Okay, fine. So then the instructions changed to, "So you record your name and, you know, record a spelling of it, or your registration will be deleted."
Deleted.
But I would say probably 90% of people didn't record the spelling of their name. So it just got ridiculous after a while. So you know what? We take that whole thing out. People will sign up on Bell's Mind. The first time they call, they may have to record their name or something like that, just for fun. But their name will show up on the show, however they type it in, and we don't have to worry about it anymore. So.
Well, and speaking of Bell's Mind, Bell's Mind's back up and running. The conferences are back alive, correct?
Yep, they are. And, you know, things are starting to catch up, you know, back up to date. But there's some new features that actually are kind of tied into, not tied into directly to Freak Factor, but once you guys see the interface to Freak Factor, you'll...
understand.
You'll get a taste of the new stuff that's coming from Bell's Mind, and I'm pretty sure most of it nobody out there is doing, or at least not in the same way. So it's kind of exciting, and I'm pretty amped about it. But in the next couple of weeks, we'll see something. I spent probably 8 hours working on it alone just yesterday, so there's a lot of work going into it. And thankfully, I finished, you know, the biggest software project I've ever done for you know, for work, just about 3 or 4 days ago, so I'm starting to see my time free up a little bit, unbelievably.
Wow, so this was your first gig as an actual porn director then? That's what was signing you up?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, managing transgender midgets, like, you would think it'd be very easy because, you know, they're so tiny and
little
easy
people
to toss around, but they're real tough cookies. You know, they make a lot of demands.
Little people.
Yeah, sorry. You know, sometimes they like to be called midgets. You know, it's a role-playing thing.
Actually. Right, actually. In character. I gotcha.
And for them, you know, they could be a midget or they could be a dwarf. You call a dwarf a midget, and all of a sudden it takes on a whole new meaning. Definitely role-playing.
All right. Wow. Did they dress up like the Seven Dwarves? Was there a theme to the whole thing? Or are they like Tolkien, like Lord of the Rings type dwarves, or... Or both.
Or they like the Keebler elves. You know, we do all of those things. We tie them together.
Dude, this massive orgy with Keebler elves and Tolkien elves. Oh, man. All right, well, I guess let's move on with the email portion of the show, or should I say the lack of an email portion of the show, because we did not get any email this week, actually. Now, of course, we're recording a day or two before we normally do, so that's explained some of it. But we got a couple emails, none of them that were really anything to read on the air. I think we got an email about the, what was it, the Bell South and AT&T, was it?
Something like that, yeah.
So, you know, there's not really much to say about that except that it's happening. So there is one thing I wanted to kind of bring up in regards to email, though. We did get one email this week of someone who was... questioning or taking exception with our IPv6 episode of the show a couple weeks ago with Verbal and I, where they said that we had made some mistakes in the topic content, some of the things that we said. So they sent a long email about that. As it turns out, no, we were correct. We checked and verified everything, what they explained, and it looks like everything was fine. It was on point. It was just a misunderstanding in the way we spoke about it. And like we said then, and this happens on the show, and not there you can back me up, sometimes it's very hard to explain things on this medium. I mean, it's radio, and all you can do is try to verbalize things. And when you're trying to verbalize, you know, the network stack and the math behind how IP addresses are created and NATing and just all these other things that go along with it, radio is not exactly the best medium for that. I mean, I'd even say that print, even though it's old school, is probably the best media because diagrams help a lot.
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree. You can't. There's a limit to how much you can explain just through your voice. Definitely visualization helps. So.
Yeah, and so, but I did want to point out that it is perfectly okay to send us an email like that. I mean, just because this one was a little misunderstanding, we're certainly not above making the occasional mistake, so or frequent mistake. So it's perfectly fine to email us if you think we have made a mistake, because we'd rather come on the next episode and correct it and get it right than leave information out there that's not correct or unclear or whatever the case may be. So feel free to email us. You know what? Every magazine that gets published on shelves has mistakes, and the next month they'll put an undo, I think is what Wired would call it, and different magazines do corrections. Newspapers do corrections all the time. Even Slashdot has Slashback, where they go back and clarify or touch on anything that was incorrect from previous stories. So, you were going to say something?
If we make mistakes, definitely let us know about it, especially me, because most of the time I'm not making mistakes. I just fabricate everything just to make myself sound smart.
Either that or you're shit-faced drunk. You're completely drunk.
What's that?
I said either that or you're completely drunk.
You know, you have a couple of 40s of Steel Reserve every day, and it happens.
There you go. All right, well, hopefully you're not too drunk this week, because we're going to move on to our main topic quickly. And our topic this week is virtualization, which is something I've mentioned on previous shows that I wanted to talk about, because I do think this is a very big thing, and I think this is a lot of, you know, again, a lot of our listeners out there probably are familiar with this and know a little bit about it, but we're going to talk about what virtualization is and running virtual desktops, running virtual environments for whatever reason, talk about what they are, how they work, give you some samples of different software packages out there that will do that for you, and go into some detail of not only what they do generally speaking, but what they might be, what you might be able to do with them as a hacker, what interest you might have as a hacker to have a virtual environment like that. So, that is why we have Captain Rosebud, no, Johnny Swank on the show with us this week, because you swear by virtualization now. You absolutely refuse to do anything that's not virtualized now.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I got into it, you know, maybe a couple of years ago, and it worked all right, but the state of virtualization today, I literally have nothing installed on my machine other than my virtualization package and my virtual machine, and that's it. And I don't know, it makes my life a lot easier, because easier to reinstall on a virtual machine than it is to reinstall your actual machine. So,
So each one of these each one of these virtual machines is completely 100% independent from your actual main machine, your main box?
Yeah, definitely.
Nothing, no overlap whatsoever. No way, nothing can sneak out at all.
Well, that's not entirely true.
Okay.
You can set it up so that you can go between the two. Like, you can set up file sharing between the two and all that kind of stuff. You can actually, even with the latest version of VMware, you can drag and drop files from your desktop into the virtual machine onto its desktop. And it basically, in the background, transfers it over Windows file sharing secretly and then lets you copy things in there like that.
Well, so it's really like a second box then, is that? It's really just a second box. You're transferring files to a second machine, not into the virtual machine per se.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as as far as your system knows.
Yeah. But, I don't know, have you used any virtualization products before or anything at all?
I've used Microsoft's in a limited capacity. We ran some Linux environments under Microsoft Virtual Server, and it was pretty much just to run dedicated, like I think Spam Assassin one time. We had an interface with Exchange somehow. Very limited. Very limited, I'll say.
Well, when I got started using virtualization, I had kind of a not such a great reputation because it was slow. It was balls slow. I think the first one that I used was called Fox, which is spelled B-O-C-H-S, and it appears that they still have this project alive and well as of 2 months ago. Big problem with them was they virtualized everything. They virtualized the processor, they virtualized all the hardware and everything like that, which has advantages and disadvantages. The problem with virtualizing everything is that it's really slow. Like, you have to build in software a little virtual processor and then run your software on top of that virtual processor. So every instruction that's being executed on this could be thousands or tens of thousands or even millions of instructions on your actual processor. So you're looking at a huge performance hit. New virtualization products don't do that. What they do is they run the code natively, and they have the hardware virtualized. Not all of the code runs natively, but most of it, as much as they possibly can. So the advantage of that is that it's faster. The disadvantage is that you can't run other platforms. Like with the previous virtualization, like Box, you could take a Sun machine and you could run Linux on it because it virtualized the whole processor. But with something like VMware, you can't do that. If you want to run Mac software, although I don't know why you would want to do that, or if you wanted to run Sun software, you can't do it on something like VMware. But it's a lot faster. The penalty for virtualization nowadays is minimal enough where I don't even notice it. So you said you've used Microsoft's virtualization package. I've heard that it's actually pretty fast, comparable to VMware. Some people even say faster, but
well, it's actually
the performance of that.
And what I used to clarify was like their very first generation of it. So I know it's come a long way since then. This was the very first generation, 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. It was quite a while back, and really I worked in the, I had to work inside of the environment. I didn't do any of the setup of it or installation or any of the stuff like that. So maybe we should back up and talk about, okay, we described kind of what it is, but I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it wrong to think of it like when we create ISO files to burn CDs or something like that? You'll burn something to an ISO, which is an image, a mountable image, even if you use some of the tools out there that will let you mount it virtually. It's doing kind of the same thing. And virtual servers, you can create an image of whatever environment you want it to be, and you basically just, is the term mounted or just activated, or how would you explain that?
Well, in VMware terms, I think the term is play. So you have a virtual image, and you can load that onto any VMware server or VMware workstation or VMware player instance, and just pop it in there and hit play. And the virtual the image that you have basically specifies that I have a machine with X number of hard drives. Each one is X number of gigabytes, and the machine has this amount of RAM. You can also specify other virtual hardware, like mice and other things like that, modems. So basically, your virtual machine file will say, okay, I've got a machine with 1 gigabyte of RAM, 480 gig hard drives, and a USB mouse and a virtual CD-ROM drive, something like that. So then any least a gigabyte of RAM and the hard drive space for that. They can copy that big image file, bring it to their machine, hit play, and start up the machine. And and it'll run the same on your machine as it runs on my machine. There are some exceptions to that, but they're few and far between.
And you were telling me one time, I believe, that you were actually taking images and using them on one box and taking them home and continuing working where you left off easily because of that?
Yeah, what I would do is I had an external hard drive, and I would take my images from my desktop machine, and I would put them on the external hard drive when I went traveling or something like that. Because some of the images I have are bigger than the free space left on my laptop drive at this point. So then I would travel, and I'd be in a hotel room or whatever, and I'd plug in my drive and, you know, boot up my virtual machine that had been running on my desktop, but now boot it up on my laptop, and it worked just fine. And it's nice because I always have the same environment wherever I go. I don't have to worry about, you know, installing my development environment on two machines, worry about the licensing for two machines, and then, you know, make sure that everything is matched up and all that. You know, my source code, my development environment, all that stuff stays on one image that I just move around wherever I need it. And if I go to a friend's place or whatever and they want to, you know, check out what I've been working on, I can just bring my external hard drive and boot it on VMware Player and show them what I've got. So it's basically like I can take all of my stuff, freeze it at any point in time, and bring it somewhere and say, this is exactly where I left off.
Now, you say freeze it at any point in time. So let's say you've got a virtual environment that's, I don't know, let's just say it's a Windows XP image with, I don't know, 15 apps installed to it, development, Visual Studio or something like that installed. Do you keep your source trees and stuff like that on there as well, and they're part of the image, and every time you make changes, do you update the image, or do you keep the source separately somewhere else, or kind of clarify that a little bit, because I think that's a little confusing.
Okay, well, actually, what I do with my source code is I have it on a web server, on an Apache server that's running Subversion. So I check out my code and update my code through that. So even if I'm not using the same image, I can just check out my code and always have everything up to date. You know, I check in. Once I'm done working on it, I check it in, and then I can check it out from anywhere else. But yeah, the source code is local on the actual image. I just check it out through Subversion.
You just need the client to connect to Subversion and pull it down.
Right.
Okay, and
if I ever get out of date, I can just tell Subversion, go to my web server, update the code to the latest code. If I happen to have, you know, if I happen to be working on the same project on, like, multiple virtual machines, I can do that. So that's how I synchronize my source code. That's a little confusing, but...
Well, and you mentioned something else, too, that's a factor to think about, and that's licensing. Is there any issues? Are there any issues, I should say, with licensing? Let's say, again, using a simple example, you have Microsoft Office installed on your main box, but then you're running virtual machines, you're playing different virtual environments there. Can each one of those have Office installed as well, or is that illegal? Is that breaking the licensing agreement?
You know, it all depends on the software company. I think that Microsoft's license agreement lets you have two copies of Office. I'm not totally sure because I don't use Office, but I was talking to somebody about it.
Don't hold us to this.
What's that?
I say don't hold us to this. We're not lawyers. We're just...
Yeah, this person that I was talking to seemed to be under the impression that you were allowed to have, if you bought Microsoft Office, that you could have it on your desktop, and you were allowed to have a copy on your laptops that you could travel with. But you should only be using one of them at a time. So technically, if you had a desktop and a virtual image, I would imagine that you'd be allowed to install it on your desktop and in your virtual image. As long as you were only using one of them at a time, that you wouldn't be breaking the license agreement. But honestly, what I would do is I would forget installing it on your desktop altogether. Just install it on the virtual image and bring the virtual image around to you. I think you have fewer licensing problems when you do it like that. As long as you're not making copies of the virtual machine and, like, handing it out to your friends, then it's okay.
So do you have anything really installed on your main machine?
Let's see. I have VMware. I have Verizon Access Manager, which is for my EVDO card, and that's it.
And everything else is installed via these sessions?
Yeah, the only other stuff, the only application, actually, that I have to install on my main machine, I don't have to, but the performance is much better, is Google Earth. For whatever reason, on my laptop, hardware acceleration, 3D acceleration, doesn't work. VMware has support for it. It's experimental, but Google Earth runs really slowly. So I installed that on on my main machine. So I have kind of three applications. There's some other miscellaneous crap that came with my laptop that I'm too lazy to uninstall, but I don't use any of it. So I try to keep everything at a minimum, which is nice because my machine boots up really, really fast now. Both my laptop and my desktop just boot up ridiculously fast. And I can junk up my virtual machine and not worry about it. If I ever need to reinstall it, just restore a previous image, and I don't have to go through all the hassle of, you know, spending an hour reinstalling Windows. I can do it in 5 minutes.
Right now, and you'll create your image, your standard image that you want to mount each time with whatever your regular apps are, and let's say a new app comes out that you want to install and keep on there persistently. Is it easy to update that image, or do you make a completely new image and trash the old one, or what do you do in that situation?
Well, there's two ways you can do it. You can either kind of manage it yourself, like you can have your virtual machine, install everything you want on it, and then power it off, and then take the virtual machine file and just archive it somewhere, you know, RAR it up, put it on a CD, and, you know, put it in your desk somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Just hold on to it for the next time you want to make a copy of it. You can do that, and then anytime you add new applications, you know, you can do the same thing. Add a new application, shut your machine down, archive the whole thing and put it on a CD. You can throw away the old CD or keep the old CD, whatever you want to do. But that's one way to do it. If you have VMware Player or VMware Server, that's really your only option because they support what's called snapshotting, where I can say, I want to be able to go back to this point in time. So I can be running my machine, install my application, create a snapshot, do whatever I want to do, and then roll it back and go back to this one point in time. But you can only do that once with VMware Server and VMware Player. So you're better off archiving it yourself, like I said, on CDs or DVDs. With VMware Workstation, you can create as many snapshots as you want. So you can, what I do is I create, do my Windows installation, create a snapshot there. Install my development environment, create a snapshot there. And then from there I start, you know, building my applications and doing whatever. So if I ever need to go back to my pristine Windows installation or make another copy of it, I can click on that installation, click clone, and have another copy without having to dig out my CDs or do anything funky. So VMware Workstation, if you're going to be doing a lot of development, definitely the way to go.
Well, it sounds like the snapshot is a really cool feature. I mean, it's like basically a rollback or a commit in database terms. I mean, you can always roll back, especially if you've been working on something and just make a mistake. You can roll back to the previous point that you have stored and not have to do it. Sounds like it would save a lot of time, but you say it only lets you do one of those?
Oh, yeah, on the free ones, VMware Server and VMware Player. They're free, but the pay version, VMware Workstation, you can do as many as you'd like. And you can get complicated. You can have trees of snapshots. Like you create your development snapshot, and then you could roll back to your pristine snapshot and then make, you know, some type of like desktop application snapshot and have those two in parallel. So you could switch back and forth between those whatever you'd like. Nice. So you want development, you go to your development machine, which is just a snapshot, or you can go back to your desktop application machine, which is just another snapshot. And that, I mean, that's really, really useful. If you're working on a project and you either don't have source control or you're working on something that's difficult to use source control with, like a lot of binary files or something, you can use that kind of as your poor man's source control. You know, and if you blow something away by accident, before you think you're going to do something, you know, destructive or something that might have, you know, something that you can't roll back, just create a snapshot and then go and work along. And then once you're done, if you need to, roll back the snapshot. If you don't, delete the snapshot and reclaim all disk space.
Yeah, and you said, you know, source versioning. I mean, that's exactly what it sounds like. I mean, you can go back, especially with the different trees. It's a perfect description. You can go back and find at any point in time what code you want to go back and check and see what changes were made. So it's like the features of a versioning system, except applied towards virtual PC, virtual environment.
Yeah, exactly. It really is source code or source control for your VM images.
For your applications, yeah. So, all right, so we've mentioned a couple here as we've been talking, but let's make a quick, it's probably a pretty short list, isn't it? How many different virtual software packages, I don't know is there a proper term? I don't, it sounds kind of weird. It sounds like a long title to call them, virtual environment software. I don't know what else to call them.
Everyone I know calls them virtualization packages.
Okay, just virtualization. Okay, so we know we've mentioned Microsoft Virtual Server and VMware.
Right.
Now,
some other ones. Like I said, there's Box, which who knows the status of that now. But there was another one that somebody was telling me about the other day. I thought it was called QEMU. Yeah, Processor Emulator. But I don't really know how well that works. I haven't personally touched it. It may be the greatest piece of software ever, but I've never used it. As far as I'm concerned, VMware works for me. You know, it runs a little bit nicer than the Microsoft one that I've seen. All the reviews I've seen say that VMware is light years ahead of Microsoft. So,
really?
You know, I had to buy it for business anyway, so I figured why not use it.
Right, right.
But that's kind of, I guess you could say I'm kind of stuck with VMware, but nobody's really told me, like, oh, man, you've got to switch off VMware because this other platform is so much better. And once I hear somebody say that, I will definitely try it out. But until that point in time, I haven't really been looking around for anything else.
Well, I do know that we mentioned license earlier. I do remember that with Microsoft Virtual Server that they did make, I mean, one of the benefits that they pitch people to buy Microsoft Virtual Server was that it does save you money on licensing. So I guess
right.
There is some sort of exception that they allow you to have, you know, if you're going to install a bunch of virtual Windows NT environments or 2000 or whatever, that they're not going to charge you for each extra one. I guess with the virtual server, they allow you to have more images for less money or the same money or something like that. So that's if that's a factor at your, you know, for business application, if you're an all Microsoft shop, you know, even it might just be better for you to go with the Microsoft solution. If you're already that much in bed with Microsoft, you're kind of screwed anyway.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. But yeah, I've heard about those little loopholes where Microsoft says, you know, if you're using VMware, you're going to have to pay for extra licenses. But if you use our package, you get a special deal on licenses.
Right, right.
Which I think is really the only way that they can sell their virtualization product.
Well,
because I haven't heard anything great about it, really. Everything I hear is that Microsoft can't catch up VMware.
Well, it seems like I've read some articles where they're trying to. They're certainly still putting a lot of development time into their virtual server package. So I know they're trying. Now, whether they do or not, I mean, you got a lot of resources at Microsoft. I mean, look how they've caught up in every other. They fall behind on so many applications. They throw money at it and eventually catch up. I mean, look at the browser wars from back in the day. I mean, IE came out of nowhere and possibly through some shady means, they ended up dominating the market and still do, as much as we all hate to admit it sometimes. Office, I mean, look at Microsoft Office. I don't know if anybody remembers, but WordPerfect used to be the Office suite that you would use. WordPerfect suite, WordPerfect what was that, Lotus 1-2-3?
Nice,
and Microsoft
nice
comes in, and DBase 4. I remember I learned DBase 4 back in the day. So Microsoft certainly can play catch up pretty well if they throw the money at it, and I don't know if there's that's interesting. I'm going to check that out after the show and see if they're coming out with a new version of Virtual Server anytime soon. What is the, I don't even know what the latest one is. Do they number them like everything else? Virtual Server 2003, 2005? I don't know the answer to that.
I honestly don't know. I just did a Google search for it. First hit is Microsoft Virtual Server 2005 R2.
So they must.
The one thing I gotta say about it is that VMware seems to have more like cool features for developers, but people tell me that the performance of Virtual Server, like I said before, is equal to or better than VMware. If performance was really an issue for me, I would probably check it out. I'd probably look into Virtual Server a little more, but performance isn't really all that important to me considering what I'm doing.
Well, all right, and let's talk about that a little bit, and let's break down a little bit more than we've already done about how these things work. I mean, virtualization, it is taking every bit of hardware that you have and loading it into memory, virtualizing the drivers for every bit of hardware, virtualizing, gosh, I don't even know how to put it into words. You can probably do it better than I can.
Yeah, it's it's kind of, you know, instead of having just a physical piece of hardware that's a graphics card or, you know, a hard drive controller or something like that, you know, they just write a piece of software that kind of emulates what that would do and then translates that to your host operating system. So when your virtual machine says, I need to write this block to this part of the disk, it's really not writing to that part of the disk. It's telling VMware, hey, find where this block of my virtual disk is on your host operating system and write to it for me. So that's where your performance gets impacted, because you're not writing directly to any piece of hardware, there's always that layer that sits there and has to kind of translate in between the two. You're never drawing directly to the screen unless you're using an experimental acceleration. You're never writing directly to the disk unless you're using, there is an option to do that actually in VMware where you can, you know, tell it, this is my physical disk, write to it directly. You're never playing directly to the sound card. You never, you know, you've always got to go through that layer. So whatever software they've written there, unless it's really super efficient, you're going to notice it. But like I said, for me, the performance is so good for me that I don't notice it. And if I was doing something that was really processor intensive or really graphics intensive like Google Earth, then I would notice it. And that's the only exception that there's been for me so far.
So for every piece of hardware, it has to load into memory all the support and everything that it needs to interface with that virtual piece of hardware that it now has. So performance-wise, and you and I have had this discussion, debate, argument a lot of times, and you keep telling me over and over again that it's more efficient than I believe, but it seems like that is a huge amount of overhead to add, especially in Windows operating systems, which already has horrible, huge overhead and using lots of memory just to boot up your standard desktop, and then you're going to boot up or play or whatever term you want to use, your virtual environment, which is going to do all the same thing, which is double in my mind, plus whatever applications and other things you have running inside of that. And then if you've got a lot of reads and writes to a virtual disk, to use your example, that's going to eat up even more memory. It just, it seems like, and again, I trust that you're telling me that it's not as bad as I think, but it just seems like that could really, really eat up your CPU, that you would just be so slow that it doesn't seem like it would be usable. Obviously, I'm wrong, because I have seen in shops that I've worked at where they had two or three virtual windows open at the same time. So I'm sure, basically, it certainly cannot be as fast as running just your environment natively. It certainly can't be as fast as that. But, I mean, what kind of degradation do you get, and does it further with each extra window or each extra virtual environment that you open? Does it degrade exponentially, or do you usually just use one?
I usually just use one, but there are a few things that I've needed to run multiple virtual machines at the same time. VMware calls them teams. So you can have, like, let's say four machines in a team. So I pop open, instead of just my one virtual file, I pop open my team file, I hit play, and then all four machines start up. You can notice that there is a slowdown, at least when the machines are starting up. But honestly, if you look at typical, you know, straight up, you know, end user usage patterns, I mean, how often is your CPU really maxed out during daily use? If you're like editing video or something, yeah, it's maxed out all the time. But when you're sitting there like browsing the web or doing something like that, even using Visual Studio, unless you're building, your CPU really isn't pegged. Your disk really isn't pegged. So,
I'm thinking more memory.
If you're doing something processor intensive or disk intensive, might be noticeable, but unless you're really slamming the processor and disk all the time, I don't think the average user notices it.
Well, I'm thinking more along the lines of memory.
No, memory is... See, the part of memory is really not... That's not really too much of a bottleneck, because what VMware does is it allocates, like, a huge chunk of memory. You know, if you need 512 megs for your machine, it allocates a 512 meg chunk of memory. It's a contiguous chunk of memory, so it's addressing that memory directly. So the translation there, the penalty is almost non-existent.
Well, and if you've got three virtual environments, each of them needing 512, you need 1.5 megs of RAM just for those, plus whatever you're natively running. So I guess let's go back to emphasize, or not go back, but let's emphasize the fact that you really need some power to run this too, right? You can't really put this virtual server and run it on your laptop that has 512 megs of physical memory on it. You're going to run into problems.
Maybe if you wanted to run some small, Linux machines. But if you're only running one machine, it's not a big deal. If you have a Windows installation like mine that has nothing on it, you know, it really doesn't take that much RAM to boot. You'd be surprised. So that little bit of memory that it takes up, you know, plus your 512 megs, you know, if you want to run a 512 meg machine, you've got 768 megs of RAM, you're going to be fine. If you want to run multiple machines, yeah, you're going to need a lot of RAM. You're going to need, you know, a decent processor. But the thing is, you're getting four machines out of one.
Right, which is the whole main benefit, of course, that they're all touting and pushing this towards businesses who are all about the bottom line. If we can run four machines for the one machine, the price of one machine, but we can get performance of four out of it, you know, in their minds, that's a great deal.
Yeah, and I know work with a couple of companies for my job that they're running VMware ESX server, and we can get into that later because it's a lot more involved than just the regular VMware products. They're running that, and they're virtualizing, you know, 20, 30 machines on one single box, and performance is just, they know how to tune it really well, and, you know, they've got serious horsepower behind it. Performance is just awesome.
Really? Well, I think this is probably a good point. We're still talking about the different packages and performance, so maybe, what is the ESX you said?
Yeah, VMware ESX server. VMware regular server and VMware workstation, VMware player that I was talking about before, they're applications that run on either Linux or Windows. VMware ESX server is its own operating system. When you get ESX server, you don't install anything on the box other than that. So when it comes up, I don't even know what the interface looks like on it because I've never seen one of these boxes in person. I've only seen the administrative interface remotely. But It's just running VMware, so there's much less crap in the way. You're not asking Windows to write to the disk for you. You're just VMware ESX server is doing everything for you as efficiently as it possibly can.
Well, that sounds brilliant to me.
Yeah, it's great. And the really nice thing about it is, and what people really get excited about is it has this great administration tool. So you can, let's say you have four or five ESX servers. You know, they're running 10 machines apiece. You can pop open this tool and you can see, you know, how much disk activity is going on each server, how much the CPU is used, how much memory has been used, and all that. And they have this thing called vMotion, which you have your four servers, and you notice that one server really isn't doing much of anything, but the other servers are kind of pegged. You can click on a virtual machine, and you can say, move this virtual machine to this underutilized server. In real time, it takes the image, moves it across the network, and without the machine going down, and without the end users even disconnecting from it,
what?
It just moves to the new machine.
How? How in the hell does it pull that off?
It requires kind of a tricky network configuration. All of these machines have to be sitting behind a particular type of switch so that they can share IP addresses. But I've watched somebody do it, and it's amazing. He pops open a window, and he's pinging this box, and he says, okay, now I'm going to move this virtual box from one machine to another. And the pings are going, like, you know, less than 1 millisecond. As the machine's moving, a couple of the ping packets is like 2, 3, 4, 10 milliseconds, and then it goes right back down to less than 1 millisecond. And that's the only thing I noticed. Like, he was on the machine running applications, no problem.
That is uber.
Yeah, it is definitely uber elite. But the things that are required for it are obviously fancy network config, like I said, where they can share IP addresses and the network won't freak out. Gigabit connections between all the machines. And you need a SAN. The virtual image has to be stored on shared storage, which isn't really a big deal. These companies have like a SAN from EMC or EMC or something like that that's super fast and just tuned to the max. So one server, basically, all it's transferring is the contents of RAM from one server to the other. And then once that contents of the RAM are moved, then it can just take over completely. But magically, while it's transferring, it still works, which is just amazing to me.
Yeah, that's pretty damn cool, I have to say. But let's reel it back a little bit because maybe there's a few of our listeners that might be able to bankroll something like that. But that sounds like some big money corporate solution type stuff there.
I think when you get into the VMware ESX server, you're looking at like a starting cost of somewhere around $25,000 or $30,000.
Good, googly moogly.
Yeah, and that's not including hardware. I think that may just be the VMware licenses. It's very expensive, but huge companies that have, you know, they have like, you know, 8 processor Xeon machines with, you know, 64 gigabytes of RAM.
Right.
No, they're looking, they don't want to spend the money on buying, you know, 40 machines. The problem with that is you've got 40 times the hardware that can fail. You've got, you know, 40 times the startup cost for buying all these machines. Like each power supply, you gotta figure, you're buying 40 machines, you're buying 40 power supplies. If you can just buy one big efficient power supply, you're making out like a bandit. And just power consumption is another thing that people are really conscious about now because energy's getting really expensive.
Right.
VMware markets that and they say, you know what, you'll cut your power utilization by, you know, 50% or even 75% at some places like that. So they can give you a return on investment statement that that really impresses a lot of business people, and it's no bullshit. You know, you really do save money when you do it right.
Right.
So VMware ESX, definitely, like you said, it's not for just any user. It's for a big business that needs to save money or needs to be more efficient or needs their admin to, you know, be able to administer more machines and you know, squeeze even more pennies out of people's pockets. But not quite for the end user. So
all right, well, let's back up, and what do we propose then? Let's say our listeners are intrigued by this if they weren't already using it and want to try it out. They're not going to buy this ESX server or anything, so what options are there available for free or cheap or reasonable price that they can download? It was the VMware. There's a free version?
Yeah, there's two free versions of VMware. Okay. There's VMware Server and there's VMware Player. VMware Server basically lets you install multiple operating systems on some machine remotely. Mm-hmm. And you can have a bunch of users connect to it remotely and use what they call the VM console to view it. It's kind of like VNC, but you know, you're not tied to just the GUI. You can like reboot your virtual machine and get into the BIOS and do all that kind of stuff. It's really cool. So if you need to share virtual machines between a bunch of users, VMware Server is the way to go. Okay. If you're just looking for something quick and dirty on your own machine to play with, you can check out VMware Player, which is very bare bones, very simple. Like I said, it only supports a single snapshot, but user interface is very simple. You do file, open, you give it the virtual machine file, and you click play, and it starts.
What's the format? What's the extension or the format for those files? They're not ISOs, right? There's something else?
No, there's a couple. There's the VMware file that you do file open on is a VMX file. So there's the VMX, which describes the virtual machine. There's the VMDK, which is the virtual machine disk files.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a VMEM file. So if you pause your machine while it's running, it takes the contents of memory and dumps them to a file. So you'll have a VMEM file in the directory. If the machine's powered off, there's no VMEM file. It's only for pausing and restoring. So if you intend on moving a file, if you intend on moving a virtual machine, you've got to move all of those files from your current machine to whatever machine you're putting on. Otherwise, it just won't work. But yeah, in any case, VMX is the file extension.
All right, and you would recommend then what minimum hardware to run that free VM player?
Well, it depends what type of images you're going to use. And
right.
For a lot of people, you know, we haven't even gotten to how you create an image or how you go through the whole install process of an operating system on this. But the nice thing about the VMware community, as they call it, is that people out there have already created virtual machines that you can just go onto the VMware site and download. Now, obviously, they're not Windows machines. They're, you know, they're Linux machines. They call them VMware appliances, I believe, or virtual appliances.
Hmm.
You can go on there. If you want to experiment with Gentoo, if you've never used Gentoo before,
right.
Best Linux distro ever, you can just go on there and download a bare-bones Gentoo virtual machine. You don't have to worry about learning how to install it or any of that crap. You just grab the file, put in a VMware player, click play, and it boots up. You follow the directions. It says, hey, I created this Gentoo image, and you can log on. The root account is root, obviously. The password is root, and get right in and play around. It's got, you know, applications X, Y, and Z installed.
Well, that's cool. Now, I have to take exception with your best distro ever, because I think all of our listeners know that you swear by Linspire, so let's not joke around.
Well, you know, I always want to promote Linspire, because I own a big portion of the company, but I didn't feel like I could get away with pimping that. But since you brought it up, yeah, Linspire is the ultimate distro.
Linspire.
It's actually going to be our slogan in the next couple of months once I take over the company. Linspire, the ultimate distro.
Well, that's why you're so big into LAMP, because the L doesn't stand for Linux for you. It stands for Linspire.
You're damn right it does.
And MySQL, your other favorite.
No.
So.
MySQL is the worst piece of software ever.
Oh, man. Yeah, hate mail. You can direct that straight to him. No, send it in to radio@binrev.com. We didn't get an email, so we'll take hate mail. Whatever. Alright, so that's kind of a cool thing, though, that you can download, instead of downloading a full ISO and installing it on a box of your own, you can download the virtual ISO. I don't know if that's a good term to use, but a virtual session of it. Now, you said obviously not Windows, and that's, again, because of licensing, right? Obviously.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, they're not going to let you download copies of Windows under any formats or circumstances. So, a lot of different Linux distros, probably like Solaris 10, which was released as a free. There might be one for that, that sort of thing. Well, that's kind of cool. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's get into then some applications of this. We've kind of briefly passed over them as some examples, but you talked about development and developing how you keep your source code off somewhere else. What benefits do you get out of from testing? I mean, you're testing your code on here, and I guess obviously if you just completely screw up your data or screw up your environment somehow, you can just kind of reboot it, for lack of a better word, or stop it and replay it.
When I'm developing applications, every once in a while I'll get myself in a situation where I say, I need to, do some type of, let's say I need to just edit an image or something like that. I don't have any image editing software, so I go and I Google around and I find a bunch of stupid packages. But I'm always afraid on Windows to install anything because I know as soon as I install it, it's married to my machine forever. Even if I uninstall it, it's still there, collecting my credit card information and sending it off to Russia and doing all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So what I like to do is if I say, okay, I'm stuck, I need a weird utility that I've never used before, I've never heard of the other people who've written it before, I take my VMware workstation, I create a snapshot, and I call the snapshot, about to install Wacky Paint 2000. And then I go and install Wacky Paint 2000, I mess around with the image, I do what I need to do, see if the application even does what I want it to do, and once I'm done with it, I revert back. And it's like it's not like I never installed it. I really did never install it on that virtual machine. So if you need to go and get any piece of questionable software, or even any piece of software that you're just going to use once and don't want to use again and don't want to be stuck with it forever, snapshots. That's the best thing in the world for me. Because I never feel like my machine's just going to get cracked up because of somebody's poorly written application.
And if you decide you actually like Wacky Paint and you want to keep that on the image, you just update the image to include that install on it.
Yeah, I can just take the snapshot that was called before Wacky Paint and just delete it, and that's it. Then my current snapshot is my working copy.
Okay, so anything that's questionable you can install on there, anything you never heard of. As a matter of fact, and we're probably crossing into some, why is this interesting to hackers? We're talking about virtualization, and we're even, talking about it from a business standpoint. We're viewing it from all different angles. But from a hacker's standpoint, what would be in it for a hacker? What would a hacker like to, benefit out of that? And one of the things is, if you want to do some reverse engineering, decompiling, sniffing, any kind of tool that you want to run on a piece of software, but you don't want to corrupt your own box. Like, for example, I've been doing a lot of research lately. I don't know if I want to say this. I guess I will. I think it's no secret. I've been doing some research on Alexa and the Alexa toolbar lately. So obviously, that's most anti-spyware packages and virus will pick that up, the spyware, and want to clean it and delete it and stuff like that. And I don't want that because I'm actually researching it. So a virtual environment would be great for that because I could go and install that into the virtual environment, sniff all the traffic. Because as far as anything knows, that is a real environment. It's not virtual. I can do everything in there that I can in my normal environment, do all the sniffing that I want, do all the reverse engineering, and save those files. Just like you save your source code, I can save those off somewhere. I can record, put them on my normal desktop, on a normal disk where I can recover them, and then just kill the image. And there's still no sign. I'm not corrupted or infected with any of the spyware or anything like that.
Right.
Is that a good example of one way to use it? And obviously, that's just one toolbar, but any toolbar, any application, we all know how much we hate those bundled where you try to download, whatever file sharing app of the day is these days, and it comes bundled with fucking Gator or fucking that purple dinosaur puppet thing that dances around the screen.
Oh, you know what? It's funny you mention that. Bonzi buddy you're talking about, right?
Bonzi, that's his name. I forgot about that, yeah.
Well, somebody I was working with wanted to, I told them how great virtualization was, and they just didn't believe in it. So I said, you know what? I believe in virtualization so much, I'll create a snapshot, and I'll install Bonzi Buddy right now to prove to you that I'm not afraid that it's going to destroy my system. Now, here's the really sad part. I actually went out, Googled Bonzi Buddy, and could not find an installer for it.
When you actually want the spyware, you can't find it.
Oh, yeah, there was just no hope. So all I did was basically, I searched for Bonzi Buddy, and I saw all the sponsored ads that came up, and I clicked to every single site. I accepted every comment cursor, every single piece of crap they wanted to give me. They wanted to, they told me my machine was full of spyware. I was like, okay, sure, fine, I'll click on that. I went to all the poker sites, everything. My machine was so crapped up,
Right.
So all I did was reverse snapshot, bam, my machine's perfect again. Which, to me, is just awesome. You know, I like getting to check out something and say, you know what, I don't have to be afraid of this crappy software. Well, I can see, you know, whatever spyware is out there, I can see what it does. I can check it out and play with it and then just be done with it.
Well, it's kind of a cool idea, too, that so you went ahead and did all that in your virtual environment. You could run AdAware or something in your native environment, and it would never see any of that stuff that's down in the virtual environment, correct?
Exactly.
And if you run AdAware inside the virtual environment, it's going to go ape shit because of all that stuff you've got installed in there.
Yeah, pretty much.
And, of course, it won't clean it successfully. Actually, that's a good thing. That'd be a good testing area to put your AdAware in that virtual environment and try to clean it. This may be a stretch here. Let's say you've got a client or somebody that your friend, a neighbor, says, oh, my computer's got tons of spyware. Can you help me clean it? Can you go and get an image of their computer as it is somehow? Can you take your laptop over there and say, image this other computer, and then take it home and play with it at your own leisure in a virtual environment all infected and run all these tools against it and see which ones work or don't work before you ever go back and actually try to clean their machine?
You know, there's a utility that VMware has. It's called PV, which is physical to virtual, which does pretty much exactly what you're talking about. The problem is it only comes with a paid version of VMware. You can kind of hack it yourself, and I did it a long time ago. I didn't do it with a Windows machine. I don't believe that it really works all too well with a Windows machine, but I wanted to copy a Linux machine, so I used it, Discomp utility, DD, and I just copied the whole contents of the drive, copied it into a big file, and then told VMware, use this big file as my hard drive, and it worked. I've done that a long time. It worked with the old version of VMware. No idea if it works with the new version. But, yeah, I think you can use possibly Norton Ghost and create VMware files from it, but I'm not totally sure about it. But yeah, that's one of the things that when you pay for it, you definitely get a tool that does that, and it works pretty well. So you can grab any machine and just copy it and play around with it.
Yeah. So if you're in the side business of doing that, I know a lot of people make a little money on the side cleaning up spyware and doing little computer errands and upgrades and stuff. That might actually be worth doing. So that way you don't have to sit at the client's place and run Spybot search and destroy and AdAware and then go in and try to hackstore the registry and all this other junk, and you could take it and do it at your own leisure.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it. You could, you know, take that snapshot it at the beginning, go through your steps to do all the recovery, and once you find, you know, snapshot it each time you make some progress, and then you have kind of like a map that says, okay, you want to get all the spyware off the machine, run this, and this in this order, and I know that it's going to work for you.
Right, exactly.
Pretty slick.
Pretty good stuff.
Man, you're pretty smart for a redneck.
Yeah, well, you know, I try to get by. I was also kind of thinking, actually, maybe let's clarify. I think we've said this as well, and it's probably abundantly clear, but just to reiterate, because we haven't said it straightforward, you can run any environment, any operating system in one of these windows, and that's true for the Microsoft or the VMware or most others. Just because you're running Microsoft Virtual Server doesn't mean you have to run only virtual Microsoft environments. You don't have to run just Windows XP and Windows NT. You can run Linux inside of there. You can run a Red Hat distro inside a virtual window inside of your Office or your Windows 2003 server running Virtual Server. And in VMware, you can run, as we said earlier, you can download a lot of Linux distros online that are already set up for you, but you can also put on Windows XP or anything for that matter. So just to clarify that the versatility that you have with this is incredible. I mean, there's really not much you can't do other than maybe if there's no, you couldn't run something like OS 400 or something that's architecture driven if the hardware is not going to be supported. If there's no drivers, it doesn't work on that hardware.
Right. Not with a product like VMware or Microsoft Virtual Server, but the older products that do pure virtualization, they virtualize the processor and things like that. If they made a version, if they made a, you know, an IBM AS400 virtualization product,
right?
You could do that. It would just be so slow, it'd be unusable.
Yeah, right. And also, and now here's another interesting question. Because of the simple fact that you know you can undo anything, It seems to me like another neat application you might want to do, and again, sticking with the fact that you say the performance is not that bad, can you set it up so that you're not really using the virtualization to open up windows and test things like we're applying it? What about a home user? Could there be a way to set it up so that when Windows, let's say you're running Windows XP at home with VMware, that it automatically boots into your virtual environment every time, like make it transparent and invisible? And every time you boot your machine, you're not really booting into your native Windows XP environment. You're booting into your imaged XP environment, which is safe and doesn't have any of the spyware and stuff like that on it. That way, if you ever do get screwed, all you have to do is back out of it, reboot your machine, you come back up to where you had a safe environment. But can you make that invisible so that most users wouldn't notice it?
Actually, it's funny you mention that. There was a company a while ago that did just that, but not exactly for that reason. They were at Hope, I think it was Hope 2000. They had a product where they used VMware on Linux, and they encrypted your whole disk file so that if anybody found your laptop, they'd get an encrypted disk, an encrypted VMware image, and they wouldn't be able to view it. But that was exactly what happened. When you booted it up, it would give you a list of your Windows installation. You'd select one, and that was it. That was you were into your box, and you if you were a dumb user, you wouldn't really know that it was VMware. But you could take encrypted snapshots, and you could revert to these encrypted snapshots, too. So when you knew you had a stable environment, take a snapshot, and that's it. You wouldn't have to ever worry about loading VMware and starting your image and all that. It did it all from all right from the Linux distro. I don't know anybody that's really doing that now, but it definitely is possible because I've seen it before.
Well, and especially, within the past few years is when the spyware problem's really, really, really taken off, It seems like now would be a better time than any to have a solution like that in place. So.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. The only reason I can think that more people don't do it is because with VMware, if you want to run Windows, you're going to need a license for Windows that comes with your laptop, and you're going to need another license to run it that second time.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's the way the Windows licensing works, VMware.
Possibly, but you know what? The fact of the matter is, and of course we're not endorsing anything here, but they'd never know the difference. Microsoft would never know the difference. I don't think...
You never know.
Well, true.
They're always coming up with new ways to screw you. There's been a lot of work, actually, in virtualization detection, and products can now detect that they are running in a virtual environment.
Well, let's go back on that direction we were heading off on about, why is this interesting to hackers? What can hackers do with this? For example, one thing that jumps to mind is things like penetration testing or any kind of tools you're developing, security tools. We don't condone going out and DOSing sites or DOSing other networks, but, certainly to computers that you own or that you're responsible for, you might want to test and see if you're secure against different things. So you might find a new tool out there. You can't go DOS some random site to test it. You don't really want to risk DOSing your own site and screwing it up to test it. You could open up two virtual sessions, install the tool to one, and attack the other. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And that would be what they'd consider a VMware team if you were using Workstation. You boot up both boxes simultaneously, and you can actually even create a virtual network segment that isolates it from everything else. You can even simulate, one of the cool things it does, you can simulate packet loss and all kinds of weird things like that in your virtual network segment. But if you wanted to do some DOS testing, you could create an internal virtual network segment between 2, 3, 4, 5 machines and use that to do your penetration testing or exploit testing and all that.
And a lot of researchers, are looking into botnets and how they work and how to prevent them. A lot of security companies are making that their major point of research. Well, you could actually install a controlled botnet. Have a team of 5, 10, however many you can handle running, and have all of them attacking one of the images and see what the effect is and how incremental it is, and test how to control it and stop it and things along those lines. The possibilities as far as that go are endless. Also, what about sniffing traffic? If you wanted to do some, test some tools for fingerprinting or active sniffing, would these virtual environments throw off fingerprinting very much? If I ran Nmap against a virtual environment, would it give me any false responses, or is it pretty accurate?
No, it's accurate. I do it all the time at work. Because at my job, we use almost all virtual environments just because, you know, it makes sense for the business.
Right.
And I can Nmap those machines, and it's right all the time.
Cool. So any kind of tool that you're used to using is not going to change in the virtual environment. So you can do all kinds of tracing. You can do all kinds of sniffing traffic between these servers. Does each one of these environments get an IP address, or how does that work?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's a couple ways you can set it up. You can set up your environment so that they're either doing bridge networking or NAT. So you're basically your Windows host or your Linux host would be like a NAT server for all of your virtual machines.
Bridging,
what happens is each virtual machine has its own MAC address, and they'll request DHCP IP addresses, and your DHCP server on the network will actually see all of these requests as if they're from completely different machines and issue IP addresses.
Oh, that's cool.
So to the network, it just looks like you have, you know, four or five machines on the same network port if your network's managed like that. But they all have different MAC addresses, and you know, they don't see each other's traffic, except for the host machine obviously can see all the other machines' traffic, but the other machines can't see each other's.
Well, that'd be an interesting try to sniff what's coming through the host machine also, just to see if it can pick up and what it can pick up. Yeah, I wasn't I didn't realize, that's kind of cool. I was just assuming that they were all being added, that's all.
Yeah, bridge networking is really cool. So you can even, one of the really, really cool things about it is, let's say I have a wireless connection on my laptop, but my virtual machine, I only have, you know, a virtual wired connection. I can just tell it to bridge with my wireless connection, and it'll request IP addresses over my wireless. So it doesn't really need to know what type of network it's on. It just, you know, it just goes out there and says, I need a DHCP address, and your wireless calling your host will do all the translation for you and get you a legitimate DHCP address from the wireless access point. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and, you know, another great application would be to open up, and maybe you could do this as a team, but let's say you were a security professional and your job was to go out and demonstrate different exploits and things like that. You could set up a team of prepared environments. So I'm going to run a version of Red Hat 7 or I don't know, with a known vulnerability and make an image of that. Then I'm going to run a copy of Windows NT running IIS, which has a known vulnerability. You're going to have a bunch of different ones, and then very easily and very visually, which again is a key to a lot of this, is better visually, show people, hey, here's like a tool like Metasploit or Core Impact or whatever tool, and actually attack your virtual servers, your virtual environments, and say, okay, that one's exploited, let me run the Metasploit script and show you that I can root that virtual session as though, you know, instead of using a real box or having to set up a bunch of complicated network infrastructure just to demonstrate and test things. You could certainly do that.
Right, right. And then one of the nice things is when you're running a VMware team, if you have Workstation, you'll see your main window that you're working on. But all of the other machines that are running in the background, you get like this little postage size, thumbnail of what's going on their screen. So if you're trying to do some type of exploit, you know, blue screens Windows or some other kind of silly thing like that,
You're
working on your machine, and you can see in this little preview window, you can see when something happens on the host machine without actually having all of these things cluttering up the machine. So it'd be very effective if you were trying to do some type of exploit that was visual to the person receiving the exploit. You know, pop up a window or something like that, or cause the machine to reboot. You can see all that going on.
Right. If you're also, well, I guess it's the same thing. If you wanted to write or develop an application, or actually, let's say you wanted to do some reverse engineering on Windows itself. Windows is very volatile. It's very unstable. What are you cooking, pots and pans banging around there?
Sorry. I poured something out in the sink. Dropped an ice cube.
There you go.
No big deal.
Yeah, that's helping out with that little medical problem you had earlier that's keeping you out of the porn action right now. I got a little ice cube.
Yeah, I got to keep ice on it.
I gotcha. No, understood. Say no more. Doesn't that cause shrinkage, though? Or?
Depends what body part we're talking about.
Oh, well, I guess I made an assumption I shouldn't have.
Jesus.
Anyway, Windows is pretty volatile in that if you go messing around with some of its binaries, it's gonna freak out and die. And by having this virtualization, you can go in there and start really tinkering with stuff. trying to reverse engineer or recompiling, like, you know, like one thing I've never ever had good luck with are different shell replacements for Windows. I've tried several of them, so please don't email me and telling me that this one's great and I use this all the time. I've never had good luck because they're going in there and they're modifying, well, the Windows shell, they're actually modifying the existing binaries, and you don't know all the interaction that Windows has put in there and the interrelationships and the dependencies and blah, blah, blah. I've never had good luck with any of those things. So this would be a way for developers to actually go in there and really do some hardcore testing of it and really change these EXEs and see how stable Windows is without, you know, ruining or risking blue screening or destroying their Windows and having to start all over and reinstall everything or try to uninstall, which never works, as you said before, because it's still got crap in your registry from 1977 before you ever installed the damn software. It's just ridiculous. So this gives you an option that you can do that, and then when it, if it screws up, you're like, okay, well, let me mark that in the didn't work column, restart my virtual image, and carry on with my testing. It would make that a whole lot faster. And the resulting software that you end up with would be a whole lot more stable because you were able to better test it.
Yeah, exactly. If you got your system to a point and you saw some weird bug that you couldn't, you know, just happened periodically, but you couldn't really reproduce it, well, you could just keep reverting your snapshot and watching the machine and saying, well, why is this happening?
Right.
You know, there's a lot of things that happen in Windows that, okay, it crashes one day, but then it doesn't crash for the next 3 weeks, and there's no way to get in there and figure out what the hell happened. So did you fix the bug, or did it just not happen again?
Right.
So, rolling back gives you a lot of ability to find all of these weird quirks that happen randomly. For Windows is pretty much everything is a random quirk. It just happens to somehow get things done. It's a miracle.
And any programmer will tell you that the worst thing to try to debug or figure out is intermittent problems. If you can't reproduce it easily, consistently, regularly, so that you can watch and see what's causing it, it's the biggest pain in the ass to try to figure out what in the world is happening and what's going on. And it's the biggest, hardest bug. Anytime you've ever like reported a bug to a site, or you've ever gone and filled out one of those forms of the problem that you've run into with the software, one of the questions is always, is it reproducible? Can you recreate it? Because that makes it a lot easier to test it over and over again. But if it's an intermittent problem, boy, that's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, and you know what? A lot of places that I've seen, a lot of companies that I've dealt with, that, you know, like different packages of software, if you submit a bug report to them without a way to reproduce it, it comes straight off the list. It's not considered a bug unless there's a way to reproduce it.
Wow.
Because they have no proof that it even happened.
Right. And, you know, as long as we're on a little tangent, a little rant here, you know the other thing that I really, really hate is how people don't seem to understand that you can't go back in fucking time. I hate it when somebody tries to tell me that, I need you to go back and give me a report or give me a file with the data from 2 weeks ago. No, the data has changed. We don't have data from 2 weeks ago. It's not there anymore because it's in the fucking past! What don't you get about that? Do I have like a fucking time travel device? Oh, that's my pet peeve. That is my pet peeve. I hate it when people ask me that. And how can you politely explain to people, no, we can't go back in time?
I think you did a very good job politely explaining it.
that was polite.
That's going to be my canned response. I'm going to get that on a little voice recorder and just play it for people.
Well, the outtakes from this show is going to be going to be made into some songs like... Anyway, maybe I'll actually play some outtakes at the end of this episode. Who knows? And another thing is, you know, not only code development, but let's say for some reason you're developing some malicious code, or you're testing it, your research company or whatever, and you're trying to test, I don't know, anything from viruses to something that's going to exploit and crash Windows or IIS or anything along those lines. You know that it's destructive in nature. Yeah, that's going to be a huge pain in the ass. Even if you have your own controlled network or environment or servers or stuff, you'll have to manually and physically reboot them all the freaking time. Whereas if you have a virtual environment and you want to release your source code into that environment and see if it, you know, an attack and see what it does, see if it does what you expect, you can do that and easily restart it, restop it. It's all self-contained. So it doesn't spread out and infect other computers or the rest of your network or the rest of the global interweb for that matter.
Right.
So,
right. And, you know, it's a little scary because every time we talk about something always seems to come out that, oh yeah, there's you know, you can use it to develop something malicious. But
right.
a legitimate use for developing something malicious is, you know, Microsoft's notoriously slow for patching their own software. But there are companies now that are doing third-party patches to things. So if Microsoft
mm-hmm.
doesn't release a patch or something, there's a company that does a third-party patch, and you can fix it, you know, a month before Microsoft ever gets to it.
Right.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of these companies are using virtualization, taking the exploit, running it against the machine, trying a patch, you know, reverting things, and just going over and over and hammering it away until they've got a patch for it. So, you know, developing malicious software actually has a use if you're also in the business of developing patches. And again, if you're not, you know, maybe you're just trying to steal money out of people's bank accounts. But
well,
there are legitimate uses for virtualization in order to develop and monitor malicious code.
Yeah, and I think most of the people that would listen to this show know the difference, that we're, you know, there can be bad applications or intent with some of the things that you want to do, but no matter what the case is, that doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about something because somebody might use it for ill purposes. I don't know. I mean, you can't shy away from talking about things, or at least talking about ideas. I mean, if somebody out there goes out and, you know, writes a virus and in a virtual environment and then comes back and says, oh, I heard about it on VenRev Radio, well, no, we're talking about it, you know, in a productive way, and how you can stop that from happening, and how you can test. Like, you know, I'm saying to people is Symantec. This would be a great tool for them to use if they're not already, which they probably are, I would imagine. They can let these things loose into these virtual environments and see how they work and test them, and therefore figure out how to prevent them and stop them in the future. You know, so, you know, we're talking about researchers, we're talking about companies, we're also talking to hackers. There's also, you know, and I know I kind of go out on a limb when I say this. I know Rax and I have had conversation about this before. To me, there's nothing wrong with researching and looking into how viruses work. It's your intent of what you're going to do. If you intend to release that virus and do something with it, you know, and there's different types of viruses. Is it the harmless type of virus? Like, remember, I don't know if you remember back in the day, the old stoned virus?
Oh, yeah.
And it would just pop up a message that says your computer is stoned. And I think it would go away after a minute or two. I don't remember. I think there's some variations. So it was, I won't say harmless. I mean, it was a virus. And, of course, you know, it's nothing good comes out of them for the most part. But, you know, we don't shy away from talking about stuff just because, you know, it may or may not be taboo, you know? For example.
Yeah. No, I always like to make the point for somebody who may have been listening to the show for the first time.
Right.
That, yeah, we're not talking about how to root your box and be uber lino and build botnets. Like, there are legitimate reasons. So before you go and run off and tell your friends, oh my God, these guys told me that you can use VMware to hack the planet. There's more to it than that.
Is there a VMware image for the Gibson?
Yeah, but you need VMware Gibson Edition, which is like 50 grand.
Damn it. So close.
I know. But you get that cool three-dimensional towers, whatever the hell those things are supposed to represent.
All right, well, actually, but we're kind of time to wrap up. Actually, this was not an abbreviated edition at all. We're full-time just about. I did have one other kind of thing. I think I know this, but maybe I'm wrong about this, but talking about the physical limitations versus the virtual limitations. What I mean by that is, for example, we briefly talked about memory earlier and how much physical you have versus how much you shave off for your different images. But let's go back to let's say for some reason you have an old network card, a physical network card in this machine that you're running that's only an old 10 megabit per second card.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for some reason it's just an old card that you had laying around. And let's say in your native session you haven't opened up any virtual windows, you start up peer-to-peer and you're just absolutely using all that bandwidth. Now, when you start up 2, 3, 4 virtual sessions, that bandwidth is still physically being used. So aren't those 4 images going to suffer because the physical capacity has been reached by that piece of hardware? And that's kind of what I was getting to earlier about the memory. When you physically run out of memory, you can't shave off but so much, and it seems like it would cause performance issues. Well, like networking, is this a better example? If you've got a limited bandwidth and you've got 4 sessions, you're not really going to be able to get any more bandwidth. You're still limited to whatever the constraints of the hardware are. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no way of getting around that.
Right.
It's got to give at some point. If it didn't, we would all just be running the whole planet off of some 286 somewhere.
Right.
But.
Right. And as a matter of fact, yeah, kind of we were talking about earlier about the CPU. I could along the same lines, I could run that folding at home or whatever, which uses 100% CPU, and I can run that in one virtual session or in the native session. There's not going to be a whole lot of CPU to spare for all the other sessions out there. So you can overload your hardware so that it will cripple your virtual session. So you do have to do it smart.
Right.
But it's certainly not a problem if you do it well, if you do it smart. And that's why your example is you just have a very bare-bones, no-frills Windows installation that doesn't have a lot of extra stuff in it, and you do everything virtually so that you avoid that problem.
Exactly.
So, all right, so I thought that was a good point to reiterate as we close out here. So, let's, I guess, jump into the shouts. I'll just give shouts to Natus again this week because, again, a cool article in 2600 Magazine, which I actually finally got. Haven't had too much time to read it yet, but a very cool article in there. So, shouts to him again. And how about you there? Oh, I got to give shouts to Mr. Pink also. Oh, and wait a minute, I'll give it to...
Well, that was
yours.
My shout, so.
Mr. Pink, Buster Cheek Spreader, and... Oh, man, what was Duel's... I forgot Duel's porn name. Well, anyway, shouts to Duel Parallel anyway.
Yeah, I guess my shouts go to Black Ratchet because he's going to be helping out with some Freak Fact stuff in the very near future, hopefully.
Hopefully.
So, shout to him. I think I'm done.
Good deal, good deal. And in keeping with our prawn theme this week, as much as I really wanted to find a Rosebud website to promote, I couldn't bring myself to look at them. But I found another great one. And actually, Johnny Swank, our mutual friend, Not Theory, mentioned this to me because he subscribes to this publication. It's called bulkmail.com. It's bulkmale.com.
Yes, for all your George Costanza needs.
great site, not safe for work, but of course this show never is. If you have any feedback on this show or any other episode of the show, if you're a new listener, if you're an old listener, if you're an ugly listener, if you're a fat listener, if you're a hot chick especially, email us, radio@benrev.com. Our closing music this week is actually one of those viral video type deals, one of those things that people are passing around, YouTube, whatever. It's called Canon Rock by Funtwo, F-U-N-T-W-O. And this is actually a remake or a remastery or whatever you want to call it of Canon in D Major, which is an old classical song by Johann Pachelbel, written in the late 1600s, but it's kind of been brought back here. A couple people have made some guitar versions of it and distributed them out on YouTube and other similar sites, which was just bought by Google. We're not going to talk about that. My good friends Google. And this was posted in our forums by Right Coast is why it came to my attention. So I ripped the audio off of that, and that's what we're going to close with. And that is going to do it. So Johnny Swank, a.k.a. Captain Rosebud, help me close out the show this week. I am Buck Dangler telling you that we will see everyone next week, same prawn time.
Same prawn channel.
Alrighty, alrighty. Mic check 1, 2, 1, 2. And you're on speakerphone. Can you hear me okay? Yada, yada, yada. Boom, boom. This will be the point where you talk. Yeah.
I was a TikTok sucker.
Hey, I don't know if you've heard the stuff that people have been, the remix songs people have been making of me lately using clips from the show where I say I'm a fucking moron. Oh, they're awesome.
I did hear some of that, actually.
Well, now they're going to use the one where you say I'm a big cocksucker, whatever you just said. Oh, crap, now they're going to use me, too. Damn it. Dude,
like
they're going to mix you and I into a song, both of us and talking about what huge cocksuckers we are.
And they're going to call it Dueling Homos.
Oh, shit, dude. I'm scared to ever release this outtake into the wild. Oh, shit.